downtown's places that historically prevented black people from visiting after sundown. White residents of these so-called sundown towns used as many means possible to keep African Americans and other minority groups out.
Until we came into this town, I really felt an eerie feeling. I had an eerie feeling about this place.
Hello and welcome to not just a new episode of the Forgot Tonya Project, but we are kicking off a new season. Our aim is to examine social problems facing rural America. And on this episode, we got to talk with a very special guest, Dr. James Lowen, who spoke to us from another time zone about his book, Sundown Towns, A New Dimension of American Racism.
Forgottonia, like a lot of stated proposals, they felt like they were kind of being left out. If you look at a map of Illinois, there are a lot of freeways in Illinois, but Forgottonia didn't have the freeway they wanted. Well, they couldn't get that freeway built. We're going to create our own little state called Forgottonia.
So just a couple things before we get started. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for checking us out. My name is Joe Brewer. I'm a high school social science teacher from Cuba, Illinois. I don't do this work alone, not even close. My best collaborators are my students who ask all of these questions. Our context is this 16-county Western Illinois region that has been affectionately or maybe angrily known as Forgottonia. We are a really unique area, and to learn a little bit more about us, go online to ForgottoniaProject.com. You can also subscribe to our blog, follow us on social media, but just learn a little bit more about us. So in this episode, we discuss sundown towns, and we were honored to speak with a talented author, historian, and sociologist named Dr. James Lowen. Dr. Lowen is best known for his 1995 book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. Now, this book had a huge impact, and it's likely many people have heard of this book. But Dr. Lowen has wrote another book. His latest book was the subject of our interview about sundown towns. And in 2005, he published this book, Sundown Towns, which focuses on communities throughout America where African Americans, Jews, and other minorities were forced or strongly encouraged to leave town prior to the sun setting. Dr. Lowen lives on the East Coast today, but he is an Illinois native originally hailing from Decatur, Illinois. So although he discusses sundown towns throughout the U.S., he especially focuses on sundown towns in our own community. We were very honored to discuss this with him. He did not just write a book on the subject, he literally wrote the book. There wasn't much known on this topic until his work. So our essential question asks, how can you know if your town was a sundown town? And Dr. Lowen doesn't just share about sundown towns, but how to develop and apply historical skills so that you can determine for yourself if your own community is a sundown town. Remember, each question was formed by our students at Cuba High School. We hope you enjoy.
Could you please tell us a little about yourself and what influenced you to research and write about sundown towns?
Sure. Let me say, I grew up, I think you maybe know this, I grew up not too far from you in Decatur.
Yeah.
Okay, Decatur, Illinois.
Yeah.
That's a city right in the center of Illinois.
Yep.
It was a nice place to grow up. I found it a little bit boring.
yeah.
One of the reasons it's boring, it's flatter than where you live, and where you live is not exactly mountainous. But Decatur is it's flatter actually than a pancake. Studies have been done of this, and it turns out pancakes are hillier than Decatur. But anyway, so I lived there, and I didn't even know when I was in high school what a sociologist was, really. But I think I was interested in stuff like that. I was interested in what caused society to be like it is. I remember asking my dad, we'd go on Sunday drives, and we usually would go on Sunday. People used to do that back then. We would usually, you know, go out to the countryside, but there isn't that much countryside. It all looks like cornfields because it's all cornfields. So I would say, well, can we go over and go in this part of town? And this part of town might be the poorest part of town, or some other part of town I had never been to, or whatever. So maybe I was interested in that kind of thing. But when I went to college, which was in Minnesota, I was interested to take a sociology course, and I decided that's what I wanted to major in. My junior year, my friends who were like in poli-sci were spending a semester in Washington, D.C. It's called the American University Washington semester. So they learned some stuff about, you know, the federal government. My friends who were in French, they were taking their junior year abroad in, France, right? And here I am in sociology, and I had never left the Midwest except maybe for a family vacation. So I thought that wasn't very competent. Yeah. And so I took part of my junior year abroad in Mississippi, okay? And Mississippi, of course, wasn't a foreign country, but in 1963, that's when this was, it was really trying to become a foreign country in a way. They were in absolute opposition to the federal government and the white people there, many of them. And, of course, the whole system was segregated. So I went to Mississippi State University, which then was all white. Some people told me proudly, some people told me ashamedly. It was the largest all-white institution of higher education outside of South Africa, which, of course, back then was under apartheid, which is complete segregation. So that's why I went there, to learn about this kind of thing. While I was there, I went to Tougaloo College, which is a black college, for 3 days, and I went to Tuskegee University for 3 days. So I learned about, you know, lots more than just the white South. I went to some other places, too, in Mississippi. So obviously then, my emphasis kind of became race relations. And I thought race relations was very important, and I think we can see race relations being very important today, you know? With things like the Black Lives Matter movement and Trump's election, you know? Yeah. So that's kind of why I got interested in race relations. And interestingly enough, my first book, which is called The Mississippi Chinese, Between Black and White, grew out of that undergraduate experience, because who knew that there were a bunch of Chinese people in Mississippi? Almost nobody knew that. But I learned it because they were students at Mississippi State. Mississippi State was all white, but it allowed Chinese.
Interesting.
We estimate that there were over 10,000 sundown towns. Sundown towns were all white towns. They could have a sign at the border saying they would run out all the black people. It took a lot of courage for a black family to get in their car and just hit the open road, you know, which is something I think in America we take for granted.
When I first learned about sundown towns was actually in college, and it was in Minnesota, because my roommate was from Edina, Minnesota, and Edina is the richest suburb of Minneapolis. And so I went home with him for Thanksgiving, because it's too far to come back to Illinois just for, you know, a long weekend.
Yeah.
And I learned that the slogan in Edina at that time was, not one Negro and not one Jew. And they didn't have one either, except maybe a live-in servant. And I thought that was kind of outrageous, you know, that a whole city would do that. And so then I didn't do anything about it, but I thought I just filed it away. Then I learned of some other towns. For example, Darien, Connecticut is famous for it, and you guys know how to rent. Maybe you know how to pirate, but never mind. You know how to rent videos. And I would suggest you want to sometime, just at home, you know, rent the video Gentleman's Agreement, which won the Academy Award back in 1947.
Okay.
It stars Gregory Peck, famous actor.
Yeah.
And it's about the agreement by which the people in Darien kept out Jews.
When Laura Z. Hobson's great story, Gentleman's Agreement, first appeared serially in Cosmopolitan magazine, its 20 million readers were startled at its daring. As a book, Gentleman's Agreement still leads all bestseller lists month after month. No story of the last decade has hit the literary world with such terrific impact. The author has deftly treated a taboo topic to give it excitement, exhilaration, and entertainment. And now, as a motion picture, Gentleman's Agreement is accorded the highest honor a picture can be given. The part of Phil Green, the fighting author, was given to Gregory Peck.
Well, face me now, Miss Wales. Come on, look at me. Same face, same eyes, same nose, same suit, same everything. Here, take my hand. Feel it. Same flesh as yours, isn't it? No different today than it was yesterday, Miss Wales.
And you know, if they kept out Jews, they kept out black folks. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I learned about that. And then I learned about Anna, Illinois. Now, I'm going to use the N-word here because they do, but of course I'm quoting them.
Right.
Anna, as you know from my book, it's right on page one, Anna was named for this woman named Anna in 1854, but in 1909 they drove out their black folks, and after that, at some point, they got nicknamed Ain't No Niggers Allowed, A-N-N-A. And I just thought that was too outrageous, you know.
Yeah.
And so kind of when I learned about that, I decided, well, this is just too much. I've got to write a book about this.
Okay, so you can't really hear the audio of this next question, so that's why you're hearing me. But after sharing a little bit about himself and why he chose to study this topic, a student asked, how many communities in rural Illinois fit your description of sundown towns?
As you know, I grew up in Illinois, so I was going to do more research in Illinois than in any other single state, simply because if somebody tells me, you know, Lewiston is a sundown town, well, I kind of know where that is, you know, it's just kind of convenient. I thought I would discover maybe 10 of these towns in Illinois and maybe 50 across the country. And you know that I'm in a count of about 500 now instead of 10, just for Illinois.
In what ways did people resist sundown towns?
Yes, that was an interesting question. Thank you. You know, it's a little bit hard to research that because what you end up researching, if you think about it, is towns where nothing happened, right? That is, it didn't go sundown. Nobody ever drove out the black people. Now, the first interesting thing is sundown towns were so common, I came to learn, that oftentimes when they did drive out black people, it didn't make the newspapers because it happened all the time. But usually it did make the newspapers, and you could also discover it through oral history, you know, talking with the old folks, and, you know, they remember when, you know, it was told to them that there used to be a sign at the edge of town and blah, blah, blah. But when they didn't become a sundown town, well, nobody writes a story in the newspaper, dog does not bite man, right?
Right, yeah.
Or tornado does not hit central Illinois.
Yeah.
So it's hard to find anything about it. But I did find some cases where that happened. And the most common thing that happened was a rich person, that is an industrialist, somebody who owned the mine or owned the company or whatever, it was demanded of him that he fire all his black employees, and he wouldn't. And usually he wouldn't because of good reasons, that is because he believed everybody should have a chance. And this was kind of the Republican ideology after Lincoln. You know, we're talking like 1880, 1890, 1900. There was still a little of that anti-racism left. Now, of course, the Republican and Democratic parties switched places on all this really around 1964. And at that point, the Republican Party became the party of racism, and they even say so today in some ways. They don't say, we are the party of racism, but they don't do that. But in various ways, they signal that they're happy to get the votes of white people who are against black people. But back then, Republicans were not like that, so we found a bunch of rich capitalists who owned companies and stuff and just resisted, and so they wouldn't do it. So that happened it may have happened in a whole bunch of towns, but I have identified at least two or three towns where that's the reason. And then there are a couple of places where I've come upon that just some person wasn't rich, didn't own a whole factory or anything like that, but he still wouldn't have it, wouldn't hear of it. And he opposed the move, and he was successful. So So that happens sometimes. Sometimes that happened in towns that had a considerable Quaker presence, although some towns were Quakers actually, you know, because the Quakers were originally very good on slavery. And but sometimes, you know, do you guys know this term, the nadir of race relations? You guys need to know that term. That's the title of chapter 2 of my book,
okay.
Sundown Towns.
Okay.
Some people say nadir. I think nadir is actually correct, but some people say nadir, and I don't care either way.
Okay.
Well, nadir means low point, and the nadir of race relations is the period 1890 to about 1940.
Oh, okay.
And in this era, even towns that were founded by Quakers, Edina in Minnesota was founded by Quakers. But even towns like that, then some of them became racist sundown towns, mm-hmm. but some did not because of the Quaker influence. And there was one other thing that I think often helped them not become racist in sundown towns, and that was if they had several white ethnic groups. In other words, if you have a town that had a bunch of German Americans, mm-hmm. but also a bunch of Polish Americans, maybe a bunch of Italian Americans, maybe some Czechs, well, then it was easier for them to put up with, if you will, some African Americans. Whereas if it was an all-German town, well, it'd be hard. They wouldn't even be very nice to the next Polish-American family that moved in.
Mm-hmm.
And they were much more likely to absolutely throw things at and drive out an African-American family.
The Green Book was a historic travel guide that was published for black people during the Jim Crow era. It was more than just gas, food, and lodging. There was everything from anything you might need on the road, whether it was like a doctor, or churches, or department stores, drug stores, there were golf courses, Disneyland was listed in the Green Book. You know, it was a pretty major guide. By the 1960s, we estimate it had been sold to over 2 million people.
So we next ask Dr. Lewin what he knows about the Green Book. Many listeners, many of our students saw the 2018 film that won an Academy Award for Best Picture, The Green Book. So we thought we'd ask Dr. Lewin how this story of The Green Book relates to Sundown Towns.
The Green Book is related to this subject, obviously. But actually, Mr. Green, I don't think he knew that much about sundown towns. Actually, nobody did until mm-hmm. I came along. I didn't until I came along.
Yeah.
How extensive they were. So what of course Mr. Green was doing was collecting the names of motels and restaurants and stuff that did serve black folks. And it would have been important to him, I think, to have noted towns where the whole town needs to be avoided. But he doesn't quite talk about that. Ironically, one of the places he lists is down in southern Illinois. The town is called Vienna. It looks like Vienna, Austria. But
yeah.
They pronounce it Vienna. Of course, in Austria, it's pronounced Wien, so it's not as if either of those pronunciations, Vienna or Vienna, is correct. But down in Vienna, he lists a motel that was open. And I've been to Vienna a couple of times, and in fact, the sign for that hotel is still up. The motel is gone, but the sign is, you know, it's like 50 years old, but it's still up.
Oh, really?
But Vienna became a sundown town in 1954, long after the book recommended it, the Green Book.
wow.
I don't know if that motel still allowed African Americans or not after the town became a sundown town. So, you know, you can't go from the Green Book and decide whether or not a town is a sundown town, one way or the other.
The 1968 Civil Rights Housing Rights Act prevented this to continue to go on, although a lot of these towns, and I have to say, had officially supported this ideology. They actually had official policy to not allow certain ethnic groups to be in their community.
And this is a good point. It doesn't apply just to blacks, African Americans.
No, absolutely not. Jewish, our Jewish brothers and sisters were not allowed to go into these towns after dark, as well as Native Americans, Asians, and Latinos.
Why did some cities target other races?
Yeah, isn't that interesting? A lot of suburbs kept out Jews. And, you know, you might do a little research on why. Again, during the nadir of race relations, it became harder and harder to be Jewish in America. I mean, for example, in another book I wrote a book called Lies Across America. Mm-hmm. And why don't you make sure your either your high school library or your community library has that book.
Sure, absolutely, yeah.
But anyway, it has 100 different short essays that treat 100 different historic sites. And one of the historic sites is a thing called the Union League Club in New York. There's also a Union League Club in Chicago, incidentally. I've even been to it. And what the Union League Club is a club for rich people. It used to be a club for rich males. They now let in some females. It was started during the Civil War to favor the Union, that is, the United States, during the war. And again, it was a Republican Party thing. It was for rich people, but it did things like support the recruitment of black troops, which was a big hot issue during the Civil War. Should we do this? And it supported them by even raising funds for them, because oftentimes companies and troops had to furnish their own uniforms and stuff. And of course, black folks couldn't do that. They didn't have any money. They had just been slaves, some of them. Yeah. Some of them were Northerners. So they did things like that. So they were kind of good on race relations. And there were Jewish members in the founding group. But by around 1905 or 1910, they made it impossible for the children of their own Jewish members to become members because they were Jewish, all right? So that just shows how much we were getting more and more and more racist for reasons I do talk about in the book, reasons like the international ideology of imperialism, which is part of this. So more and more suburbs started saying, okay, we can't have no Jews. We don't want no Jews. And another reason they didn't want Jews is because not every single one, but on the average, Jewish people are a little more liberal on race. They're not quite so racist. After all, they've known what has been done to them in Germany and also here on the basis of race. So the worry was that if we let Jews into this suburb, this rich suburb, then maybe they'll sell their house to a black person. We can't have that. So we better keep them out too. Hmm. And then we have all kinds of places out in the West that kept out Chinese. You know, and there was a big scare, of course, in the West for years how the Chinese are going to take over. And then it turns out there's even some places that kept out Mormons, or kept out, one place that kept out Seventh-day Adventists. White folks like me are amazing in the number of people we can get prejudice against.
Okay, so this is where we chose to stop for today. So thanks for listening. I just want to share a couple post-reflection thoughts and give you a little indication of what next episode is going to be about. Here's a couple things that we've learned from listening to Dr. Lowen today. First is just being blown away by the fact that there are potentially 500 sundown towns in Illinois alone. 500. Now, it's important to question methodology, and we write a little bit about this on one of our blogs, the difficulty in determining if a town's a sundown town or not, some of the pushback that even Dr. Lewin's got, but still, this is a lot to take in. And another takeaway is that it's very interesting that we can only know so much about ways people resisted. Local history in small towns like our own wasn't always documented. So perhaps we have to rely on oral history, because researching this subject is really unique apart from more conventional methodologies. So we're going to talk more about this next time and even give you some tips on how you can go about doing your own research. So thanks for listening. Now next time we're going to release part two of our interview with Dr. Lowen. He's going to speak with us about the legacy of sundown towns, as well as advice he has on doing your own research. please check out our website, ForgotTonyaProject.com, where we have and are posting some weekly blog posts about sundown towns that you might be interested to read. Also, check out Dr. Lowen's own Sundown Town webpage, where he has a massive database encouraging people, like he did with us, to do your own research. All right, thank you.
Sundown towns are actually a northern phenomenon. Works of Dr. James Lowen, who actually is the foremost authority on sundown towns in America. Well, if you think about during the slavery days, or even past slavery, because we're talking about right after, of course, Reconstruction, when these towns became very popular. In the southern states, you needed your workers to be there day in and day out, sun up to sun down, which a lot of people would say. But when you talk about going up the northern states, in the northern communities, you only needed your domestic workers for a certain period of time of the day to do the daily chores. And then after they finished, they had to leave the community. Right.